This is Dan Golodner, Wayne State University, Walter P. Reuther Library, AFT Archivist, in Helena, Montana, October 2nd, 2007, talking with Jim McGarvey. How you doing, Jim?
I'm doing good, Dan. Welcome to Montana.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Why don't we just get started with basically where you're born, raised, a bit about your family.
I was born and raised in Butte, Montana. Lived there. Went to St. Lawrence Grade School and Blaine Public School, and I went to Butte Central High School, and I graduated from Carroll College. I went back to Butte after my finishing up at Carroll College and taught at Butte High School for 6 years. I was a member of the mine mill and smelter workers and the laborers union when I was growing up. One of my first jobs was as a laborer when I was 14. I worked highway construction at 17.
And you had your union card at 14?
Yeah. And then I went to work for the mine mill and smelter workers, which later, through merger, became the steel workers.
What'd you do there? What'd you do there?
Mine mill?
Yeah, what was your job?
I was a surface lake laborer, a swamper. I worked for a department called salvage. We used to, there was hundreds of mines in Butte, and as technology got bigger, and I say technology was your rails. As the rails got bigger, the cars got bigger, the tunnels got bigger, they used to salvage out the smaller cars and the rails and sell them to, we call them leasers. They were contract miners.
Okay.
I suppose you have a lot of those. Go ahead. I'm treating this like a, that you can stop and start it and edit it out. And
oh, yeah. Whatever.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've worked in all of the mines of Butte during this time. On the surface, hauling stuff from mine to mine, and in many cases, if we needed equipment for another mine, we virtually destroyed the first mine. I helped load William Clark's records into trucks that were dumped into the pit, covered over, had a supervisor riding with the truck that took them there.
Interesting. Dumped it right in the pit.
Huh?
Dumped it right back in the pit?
Dumped it right back in the pit. I don't know if they were historical or just bills of lading.
Yeah, who knows? Well, we'll never know now.
We'll never know.
Were you going to school at this time, too?
Yes.
Wow. So full day at school, then?
No. I used to go back, and like I'd leave school, and I'd leave Carroll at say the beginning of December. I'd go to work either in the pit or on the hill somewhere, and then I'd come back and spend some time at school. They'd hold my time, and then I'd work all during the holidays, and then I'd come back to school and then go back and work a few more long weekends. And then they turn in my time. I was connected.
You had the connections.
Mm-hmm.
That helps.
They took good care of us. My generation, I don't think very many of us ever flipped a hamburger. We through the sweat and friendships and our own hard work, we always had good union jobs. From age 14 on up for me.
Still are.
Hmm?
Still are a union member, right?
Still a union. still working for the union. Back then, it was just a good union job. I like construction. I'd say if this one supervisor hadn't died at a young age, that's probably where I'd be today. He took very good care of me.
That's excellent.
Was my next-door neighbor, by the way.
Oh, that was next-door neighbor?
Mm-hmm. And my uncle was the timekeeper in the pit when I worked there over the holidays.
So it was a whole family neighborhood.
He was. My uncle was also on the school board when I went to work teaching in Butte.
That must have been nice.
Very nice.
So you started teaching right after Carroll College?
Mm-hmm.
What did you teach?
I taught sociology, senior sociology at Butte High School, and then I coached at the University of Montana, Montana Tech, in Butte for a couple of years.
Okay. What was teaching? What was the 65, 66?
I taught from 66 to 71.
What was the classroom like then?
I had all seniors. I'd say I probably never really a sick for study hall. But nothing but the good side of teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Had good students, ones that wanted to learn. I think their training, most of them had developed good habits, and the few students that I had that didn't seem to care, I had no problems in my classroom whatsoever.
Lucky.
Yeah, very lucky. Yeah. I mean, I don't think many people could say it, but these were seniors, and it was fun. It was hard because it was sociology, a moving target. At the time, I found it very hard, and interestingly enough, much of what I learned from sociology, I don't know that I could have used any other major with my union activities, but it was not planned.
No, that's true. Though. You use sociology all the time with union issues.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did you immediately join the union, or was it like you had to join the union when you became a teacher?
Well, yeah, both. I mean, I had been in two unions by the time I became a teacher. The Butte Teachers Union, I never knew anything about NEA or anything like that through my whole college career. I had been in two unions. By the way, the mine mill and smelter workers weren't an AFL-CIO union at that time. But, I mean, I never knew that in terms of, I just knew. And we were encouraged by our peers to go to the union meetings, and we used to get stamps in our books that we'd go. We'd go there on Friday when we picked up our checks and get our union book stamped and stopped at the local beer tavern on our way back to work and had a few beers. And
you still have your union book?
I do.
Cool. That's excellent. Those are neat.
I do.
Yeah.
Mine mill and smelter workers. I wish I had it right here. I'll show it to you tomorrow.
Well, I leave at 6.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'll show it to you next time.
Exactly. I'd love to see that.
But anyway, I grew up in Butte and virtually grew up on a mine dump. Mine dumps were in the early days where they just took the earth out they would be high-grading more, they would find the rock and the gold and the silver close to surface, and the rest was just thrown off to the side, and that's where the houses were built up and built on and close to the mines. We knew no different.
Just new mining. Yeah.
That's all we knew.
Right.
They were our playgrounds and baseball fields and ice skating rinks and we knew no difference.
Sounds good, though.
It was good. It was. We were poor. Remember once there was a big strike. We had an anonymous $100 bill left at our house to help us through the strike. But I guess we were like so many other people in Butte in the country. You didn't know you were poor. We mm-hmm. made the best, and the mine yards were our playgrounds. I mean, we hitch rides on the trains and put our rafts in copper poles and
right.
fell in the water.
Oh, geez.
knew no difference.
Right. Sounds good, though. Mm-hmm. So were you the first in your family to go to college?
I was.
Yeah?
In fact, in my... of my siblings, I was the only one that went to college. I had one other sister that went to a two-year school and one that went to a business college.
Mm-hmm.
Never thought about it like that. But I was the first in my whole generation to go to college.
This is just when you graduated, said, I'm going to college? Or
no, I was working in the mines and had a very good job and wasn't sure what I wanted to do. Some of my buddies in the mines encouraged me to go to school and my family. And I basically made the decision that I'd give it a look.
Hmm.
And other than going back and working in the summers and working at Christmas time, that was the beginning of the end. And this was in the 70s, and by the 80s, the mines were closed down.
Right.
So it was a good decision.
Yeah.
And it helped me, you know, get on the football team and a lot of other stuff. He must be tough if he's worked in the mines. I was a surface miner, not a not a contract miner.
Still, they hear you're a miner. Got to be tough on the line.
That's what they said at 165 pounds.
165?
Yeah.
And you're playing what?
My roommate was the biggest man on the team, and he weighed 220. That was as big as we got back in those days.
Back then, nowadays you guys are puny.
Yeah, well, he wouldn't even risk having you bumped into.
So college was the first experience. They must have saw something in you that said you should go to college, get out of here.
I'm not sure. We were told one, our parents didn't want us going down the mines. And our relatives, like I say, a lot of us were connected, and we had these day job or these surface jobs, and we were encouraged to go to school, but I don't think we were really, because I'm a union leader, that we were really educated, and it was explained to us the importance of what the union did for our upbringing. We were told we should move on, but we were never told the sacrifices that were made. And I think our parents talked about that with each other, but they never instilled it in us as kids.
Hmm.
That they all had high reverence for the union, and there were many unions, and each union had its own territory, and there was a lot of respect for it, but it wasn't like the industrial unions and the unions that I'm used to, where everybody knows everybody else's business. And I mean, if you were a boilermaker, that's all you were for your life. And my dad was a boilermaker, I had never been encouraged or trained to become a boilermaker.
Mm-hmm.
I could weld.
Right.
I could cut. I could, but we learned all that stuff because we wanted to learn it just to take our cars apart. And,
yeah. And the equipment was laying around and
mm-hmm.
do it. Yeah. So graduating Carroll College, why teaching?
I'm not sure. I applied for three jobs, one in Clark County, Nevada, one back in Butte, and one in Helena. I liked Helena. going to school, and the job came open in Butte, and I took it, and I ended up being vice president of the union my second year of teaching. I was president of the union before I had tenure. Because not by design, but more by accident.
That's how it usually happens. Yeah. It's all accident. Mm-hmm. They just saw young McGarvey would be vice president?
No, I shot off my mouth back in those days in the teacher rooms. We would talk about insurance. Back then, if you had to pay out of pocket 85 cents, it was a big fight. The insurance companies told that we had full pay, and so there was always discuss about the insurance and the different benefits. And then we had composite rate. I didn't know composite rate from a horse, but so I kind of took the side of the single teachers that it should be a tiered structure, and I was told if I know so much, I should go to the union meetings. Well, as soon as I went to the union meetings, I became a firm believer in the composite rate, and then at that time, I met one of the people who probably made one of the biggest marks on my personal and union life was an insurance man who was a hard worker, and he helped us. We owned our own insurance. The union owned the insurance, so we didn't have experts, and he felt that the composite rate was good, and we were only probably paying $40 a month, if that. Mm-hmm. And everybody had the same benefits, family and all, and that was real insurance. And I grew up with that, and I promoted the composite rate wherever I could. And because that was real insurance. After that, it was, just basically the insurance company giving you a cheaper way out, and deductibles growing higher all the time.
Right.
And in fact, the union here, which is a very small one in the Montana AFL-CIO, has a composite rate.
Still. Was this through MFT or through the Butte Teachers Union?
It started out as the Butte Teachers Union.
Right.
And the Conda Teachers Union, we negotiated with the insurance companies. They came to us. They never came to the school district. They dealt
directly
with us, and they dealt with us as union's reps. And then in Butte, a lot of people would be surprised. Butte had the first contract. But when I became president, I couldn't understand why some people weren't paying union dues and others were.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was no law for public employees then. So it was basically whatever you negotiated. But the law was a good one. The law of the jungle, that meant we struck when we felt like it, and we came back to work when we felt like it, and nobody crossed the picket line, and there was a lot of camaraderie and unity, and I must say sensibility in terms of knowing what we were after and not lingering out there on strike and getting it done and getting our raises but back then it was hard, no salary. The insurance was easy, and the other benefits were easy. But while Butte was a very highly democratic, highly unionized, it was a very conservative town,
mm-hmm.
very conservative in terms of social issues, and also conservative. And many of our brothers that made it to the school board were also conservative, and so. It was nice to have doctors and lawyers to strike against. It was tougher to strike against union people because they didn't want to see you oftentimes make any more than they were making.
Sure.
So, where was I going with this? So we came up with this scheme that nobody would participate in the insurance unless they paid union dues.
Okay.
And so that became our union security. Mm-hmm. And it was good insurance. Everybody wanted it. So two sisters sued us, and I went to the insurance company and said, we want to do business with you, and you should defend the union. And so the suit ended up, while it named the union and the insurance company footed the bill for our union security.
Pretty good. That's not bad.
I would have to say that was a high point.
That was your high
looking
point.
Looking back.
That was a good
idea. Definitely one of the high points. And that local went, even 2 years later, we got collective bargaining. It was legal to negotiate agency fee or some form of agency fee under the law. In fact, most every public employee did negotiate agency fee. But for years, the Butte Teachers Union went without any kind of union security. It held the people in the union by whether they participated in the insurance or not.
Hmm.
And so, under that system, you were not bound to Hudson or Beck or any of the reporting systems. But now they do have union security.
Right. Once again, Butte Teachers Union has one of the first things,
mm-hmm.
contract and kind of an agency fee thing.
But they didn't have the union security or agency fee in the beginning.
No. Pseudo type.
Mm-hmm. But they did have, this is long before my time, they had two-tiered salary schedule. The union members got paid one wage, and the non-union members got paid another wage, and that was later said by the courts to be unlawful.
Neat concept. That's pretty interesting. Yeah.
And
I don't think the courts would like that too much. Yeah.
And when in 1936, when the Butte Teachers Union first got recognition rights, they were resisted by the school board and the president of the Central Labor Council at the time. Brother passed away, and he was one of the school board members. Ran the mortuary. And he went down and removed his brother to another mortuary and said his brother would not be in a mortuary that didn't respect the collective bargaining rights of all unions. So that was quite a story.
That's good stuff. That's a good labor lore. That's good.
A lot of good stories like that.
Yeah. So you guys went on strike, actually?
We had many strikes before the law in Butte.
Okay.
And very few after the law.
Right.
It was just a different world, but basically, in fact, there became an inherent abuse in going on strike because they would get restraining orders and ask that the leaders be put in jail, but the judge would never, didn't think that was a good idea, so what he would do is take his bailiff and lock the two parties up in a motel until they figured out an agreement. And that seemed to work for us.
So you've been trapped in motels before, huh?
Yeah. But now this was way early in my career, and this wasn't done when I was a staff rep for MFT. This was more when a couple times when I was an officer of the Butte Teachers Union and my predecessors.
Right.
But I'd say the Butte Teachers Union over the years, and then after I left the Butte Teachers Union to work for MFT, I'd say back in the 70s and back, maybe into the 80s, but that was when the mines were closing out, wouldn't have been a smart time to be striking. I'll bet you they were engaged in 7, 8, 9 strikes. I was probably involved in 3 of those. Remember, we were taking advantage of the judicial system, if you're following me.
Yeah, I am.
That gradually the judge wouldn't restrain us and put us in jail, he would restrain us and make us reach an agreement.
The Montana's version of binding arbitration.
You might say. But now our collective bargaining law has fact-finding, mediation, and voluntary binding arbitration, and no specifics on how you would strike. It is totally silent on strike. So prudence would suggest that you plan your strike, but there's nothing that says, except for health care, that you have to give any notice.
Just walk out one day.
You just walk out.
Wow.
Now, most of the ones I was involved in, we did give notice. Mm-hmm. But we didn't get, I mean, it was notice like we're negotiating, and if we can't settle tonight, we're on strike on Monday.
Right.
And some of our early strikes, we scheduled for Friday, and we were back to work on Monday, you know.
So these weren't prolonged things. Over a weekend, maybe a week.
Well, some of them were short like that, but there were a few prolonged. Mm-hmm. But I had the good fortune of meeting a lot of people who helped influence my career, and one of them was that if you plan the strike, you also better plan on how you're getting back and what you're going to settle for. And, you know, the threat of the strike is always much better than the strike itself.
Yeah.
So striking over a weekend wasn't much more than a threat of a strike. Mm-hmm. But we would miss a Friday or a Monday. Mm-hmm. But then if you didn't have it settled on a Monday, then it just didn't seem like there was any hurry. So it could get into a longer strike.
Was it usually over wages and benefits?
Mostly always wages.
How much did the wages increase over, since you became president?
Well, back in those days, we were getting anywhere from 6, 8, and 10% raises. But so were they in Pittsburgh and other parts of the country. But those were big raises. It wasn't long after that 1.5% was a good raise.
Yeah.
And by the way, when we were getting 6, 8, and 10% raises, sometimes we were getting killed by our members for not being enough. I brought back 1.5% and got letters and receipts to go have dinner from members that they thought we did such a good job. It's just the time and the mm-hmm. and the market and the and also the more involvement you get, the more appreciation, the more buy-in, the more understanding. I mean, I found that especially negotiating in these smaller school districts with real tough school boards, that some of the teachers would do anything. But you had to be very calculating in what you asked them to do so that you didn't get them in trouble.
Right.
That you couldn't get them out of.
Right. What was the average salary, teacher?
When I started, it was about $5,000.
And when you left?
I've never left, so.
Well, when you, in 71.
In 71?
When you became executive director of MFT.
I'd say in those 5 years it had doubled. I think I was making close to $15,000 when I left.
That's amazing. That's huge.
Mm-hmm.
Then again, it's across the board, all over, teachers across the country.
But not across the state of Montana.
No,
I mean, that was back when you know, Butte had bargaining and nobody else did. And you know, we had achieved retirement back in that. Retirement came before my time, that they started a defined benefit. And then collective bargaining came in the 70s, and that collective bargaining was quite an interesting story because by and large, the people that I was exposed to in the union were pretty parochial and didn't much care about what went on in the rest of the state. I think some of it was they didn't understand that they had bargaining and conditions that nobody else had, mm-hmm. partially because we came from a labor community, and partially because we had people that were willing to stand up and fight, but partially because we could strike and nobody else would think or do us something like that without a law. And then, so when it came time, should there be a collective bargaining law or shouldn't there be, I was working for MFT. AFT felt it was good to have a law because then we could petition for elections. Otherwise, there was no labor board or PERB board, whatever you want to call it, that we could have majority rule elections. And it was basically you had to be recognized by or not recognized by a card check, mm-hmm. or just a building trades type agreement. So there weren't very many places that had that. Now they had what they called professional this and professional that, but you know, it worked to the advantage of the of management, and most of the time in the association units, the principals were part of the part of the union and part of the contract, and so the teachers were really getting ripped off. Again, we never had that in AFT. Mm-hmm. Although when my first year of teaching is when AFT put the administrators out, and there was a lot of hard feelings, but I mean there was no lingering like it was in the association. Some in Missoula, they were still in the association 20 years later. Hmm. Now some of the older teachers didn't like the idea of the administrators being put out, but the ones I remember, the younger ones, felt it had to be. And of course, anybody who came in contact with other unions, you know, wondered why they, you know, management would be in the union anyway, mm-hmm. Supervisors. So, mm-hmm. But I hope I'm going here with how we ended up with collective bargaining. So, essentially, the Butte Teachers Union, the Anaconda Teachers Union, didn't want collective bargaining because they had their own mm-hmm. form of bargaining, and which was the law of the jungle, and had a contract. But nobody else in the state did. And so as we got a few more locals, I became conscious through my AFT education that, you know, it was better to have a law. And gradually, Butte would end up getting hurt without that law, too. So all of the state employees got bargaining, but teachers always had to have this or that. And so they figured out if they put in a law without the teachers, that everybody could get collective bargaining. So then everybody in, say, 1971 got collective bargaining. All public employees got collective bargaining in the state of Montana except for teachers and faculty. Teachers by design, faculty by association. or public school teachers by design, college faculty by association. Well, then, when we were trying to organize in higher ed, so we virtually got collective bargaining like in 72 for higher ed faculty, but we were organizing in community colleges, and it wasn't until later the big election came at the University of Montana. But when in 73, when we had a favorable legislature, supposedly, and a favorable governor, and a powerful education association that was going to get bargaining no matter what. Well, there were four bills introduced. One by the MFT, one by the MEA, one by the School Boards Association, which would be management's bill, of course, and then a second one by MFT that we introduced later in the session that would make us public employees like all other public employees. Well, the School Boards Association and the MEA wouldn't hear of that. but they were also losing their right to strike, and they were making all these compromises, and it was quite a deal. And we figured out just before transmittal that, and we went to the School Boards Association and the Republicans and said that MEA is going to run away with the train, and they're going to have these collective bargaining laws that nobody's going to be able to live with. Just put us in like everybody else. Well, nobody understood, or wanted to be bothered, probably a lot of lawmakers. But they just thought they don't want to give teachers all this power. So as a result, we were amended in by the Republicans. The bill was, and the School Boards Association, but we architected it, MFT architected it. And I might say I had a very big role in that. And it would happen like that.
Really?
It just, they came out overnight. One day and says, we're going to amend them in. But the interesting thing now, when bargaining came, if you could, I don't know how, help me out if you're making a record here. At this point, municipalities, if a foot would be their scope of bargaining, they had a foot, okay? Because they had all these other laws that they were governed by. And then if you widen that state employees, their scope of bargaining would have been a little bit broader. And then if you broaden with faculty, the scope of bargaining was even broader because they weren't bound by any of the, insurance or the workday or vacation or anything. These are all in statute. And then public school teachers, it was just wide enough to drive a truck through.
Right.
So that was one of our greatest feats and pieces of fast work, and the scope of bargaining for public school teachers was wide open with no catch on bargaining, and in the beginning we negotiated. As time went on, many of the contracts got similar, but in the beginning we rued the day because we understood collective bargaining and our contracts were, now they weren't pretty,
right?
But they had lots of nice things in them.
Yeah, usually the first ones aren't pretty, but mm-hmm. You got them through. Is MEA backed by your widening the scope of collective bargaining? How did the MEA respond to this? Is there?
Well, the interesting thing was that the president of the MEA and one of the locals of the MEA supported what we did, but the association as a whole resisted it because they wanted the pride of authorship. But they understood. But I have to give credit at that time. Now, that was before Eric and I got together to form the merger.
Yeah, this is at the peak of AFT-NEA battling.
Right.
Or even, like, they were considering merger, but it was never going to go anywhere.
Oh, no, there was no talks of merger back then.
Well, here, no, but, you know.
Or anywhere. This was in the 70s, early 70s. I mean, we were at each other's throats I thought I'd turn that off. I'm sorry.
It's okay. We delete it out.
Huh?
We'll delete it out.
Okay. Well, it is off now.
Okay.
Okay. So, I guess that was back in the 70s. That was a big deal and a big start for MFT. And then we started growing like crazy.
Now, you were still the only employee of MFT?
Mm-hmm.
So you were running around the state, running to the state capitol,
mm-hmm.
running the shop.
Exactly.
Jeez.
And we had, our first office was kind of a hole in the wall up there by the capitol that we shared with a couple of young ladies that ran a stenographer, court reporting service, and we shared phones but I have to tell you that in all honesty, I think there was more opportunities than we were able to seize if we would have had more more staff. We were growing. We were, and then came along the University Teachers Union, which was the next big union after Butte, and they had a large core of people who were good unionists. They were loyal to each other. They wanted the union to have collective bargaining so that they could have a say. I mean, it was community. I mean, faculty community driven. But they taught me the value of the organized, the unorganized, and they were very helpful, and in terms of money, and in terms of support, and in terms of advice, I wish my blue collar friends had the will to do that these friends of mine had back in the late 70s and early 80s. But I think there were more opportunities, and we were rating MEA all the time, and then we turned to rating MPEA, and there were some fierce wars. We were other unions who didn't organize then and still don't organize now could never understand why we were taking their members, or why we would take these association members. Well, they were bargaining lousy contracts, and especially in state government. And I figured out early on that the way the government set up their budgets, that it was all or none. So if we had other people out there doing our bidding for us, it was none. We had to do our own bidding. And picking up the correctional officers, they had backbone and guts to strike, and did, and virtue, and we conducted a statewide strike probably in the late 80s, maybe 90s, but late 80s for sure, and I could get you the dates on those, where basically we and the association were on strike at the same time. And so that meant we had maybe 20 to 30 AFT entities that had to vote their way on strike and vote their way back to work. I'm sitting home watching TV one night, and the MPEA announces their members are going back to work. And then we were the ones who led the strike, had the key state institutions, healthcare, and the healthcare institutions and the prison. Without those, they could have crushed the MPEA. So it was our members who really struck. But we had to meet and vote our way back to work. I remember going before all the correctional officers at the gymnasium in the Beaverhead County High School. I didn't know what was going to happen to me. They didn't want to go back to work, and there were 400 people in that gymnasium. And I convinced them that, you know, we weren't going to get any more, and that we would be losing money, and that if it wasn't for them, nobody had got anything. We'd come back to fight another day, and we did. And we probably doubled the pay, or even tripled the pay, in a decade for correction officers, because we broke away from how the Montana Public Employees Association used to do it. If their belief was, it don't matter how bad you screw us, as long as you screw us all evenly. And my belief was is that if I can get extra for correction officers today and college professors tomorrow, that's the way we do it. That we're not going to hold anybody back, and that built salary pools as we moved along.
Right, right. Can we go back to the University Teacher Union?
Mm-hmm.
What you said, they were good unionists, so they were ready for collective bargaining. What was the administration like view of it, or did AUP try to come in as well?
Well, they were a very active group to start with in terms of academic freedom, but academic freedom, a lot of it was just making sure that handling grievances like a union would handle them, that... you know, some they understood that they didn't want bad teachers or faculty, but they wanted everybody to have a chance, would be my observation, mm-hmm. and that nobody should be railroaded out. And so they took a lot of cases, and so, you know, when it came time to unionize, I mean, they were naturals at it, and they had the sense of community. I mean, it's a sense of community I've never saw before or since, that in terms of making sure everybody got a chance, but also holding people to high standards.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was the thing that you didn't often see, but they held people to high standards, but they didn't want to see anybody getting railroaded. And that really impacted me in terms of, you know, my whole career in terms of how I dealt with employers. And you know, a lot of people are mistreated, but the contract isn't violated.
Right.
And that's hard to get across.
It sounds like this is one of the first higher eds to use a peer standard system. Or one of the first, they have it in a contract.
It was in the contract. I mean, they negotiated merit pay, and they still do to this day. They're proud of it. You can, if you don't perform, you can lose your tenure after so many contracts. But you also can grieve.
Right.
So it ain't like you can be stripped of it, but. The interesting thing was, is one of the bases they used as people moved, or after people got tenure, that they could be accorded less than normal raises. That would be, they would be denied a cost of living increase if they didn't, the contractual cost of living increase if they didn't live up to certain standards. And after so many of less than normals, they automatically lost their tenure.
Mm-hmm.
Very few people pursued that. I think the writing was on the wall. If you had two less than normals, that you were going to have a tough time.
Right.
But the ones that did, the union fought for.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them came back and were good teachers. But an interesting thing, there's not a lot of it. It's kind of like the right to strike. I mean, if you have the right to strike it, people know you'll do it. They'll respect you for it.
Right.
I think in this case, the administrators and the deans knew that they had to give good reasons for why they held faculty back on pay or merit or tenure track or anything else.
Because mm-hmm. it's in the contract?
Because it's in the contract.
That's interesting. I just wanted to hear that story. So you're... You're pretty much leading the MFT.
Pardon me?
You're pretty much leading the MFT as executive director.
You mean back in these days?
Yeah.
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 I started out as executive director for maybe 8 or 10 years, and then I became president.
Mm-hmm.
And so executive director was a hired position, which AFT encouraged at the time. But I think you have to have elected positions because you live or die on what you do. And I've watched associations, they hire, in fact, that's what's wrong with the Montana Public Employees Association. They hire executive directors, and they're just not accountable, and you can't vote them out.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes they have more control over the board than the board has over them in setting policy.
Mm-hmm.
And they get very, very friggin' lazy.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do.
Very, very lazy.
And a kind of also a sort of nepotism follows along.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So you really can't change anything because mm-hmm. they're just following along a route.
But, and so, you know, over the years, like at one point, MEA had most of higher education, but after we organized the University of Montana, we took all the higher ed units away from MEA. And
that's a huge grab.
Yeah, one at a time. And then about the time of the colleges of technology were taken out of local school districts and put into higher education, there was a big argument on how it should be done and a lot going on in the legislature, and this is when Eric Thiever came on the scene, and he approached it that we should go after through legislation, and I approached that we should go after it through grassroots organizing. So whatever happened at the legislature, we had our, when it came time for the election, I mean, we were able to claim credit for whatever they did in the legislature, as well as had a structure in place, and they had no structure. And I think he saw that and understood it very well. About the same time, there was an independent local in Colstrip, Montana, and a lot of people in Colstrip came from Butte. And so while we took advantage of all the weaknesses over the years, all of our, what do you call it, like all closet, all the mistakes we've made in Butte and other places happened to end up in Colstrip. So when we, and we had a minority local in Colstrip and never bothered to have them vote. We thought we could win the election. And Eric went down there and stuck with it and worked hard. And I remember one day I was getting the hell beat out of me on a, on how we'd handled a grievance somewhere else for there were a husband and wife and a cousin, and how I had handled the grievance for their dad.
Mm-hmm.
And they were angry and hate, and we won in relief, but didn't matter to them, we didn't win them enough. And this is when I first met Eric, and so they grabbed him in the hall and asked him the questions of how this went down, and he says, I think I'd have to admit that Jim was right. And which could have cost them three votes, but didn't.
Yeah.
And so I took Mark on that.
Yeah.
And it was almost like the same year that when I was on the AFT Executive Council, then they started talking about merger, and so I called Eric about they were billing off that we have lottery here in Montana, and they were billing off that if you pump money into these slot machines, that you were making it a better deal for teachers. But in fact, is what it was supposed to do is go to reduce the county mill levy, but had nothing to do with whether you that helped fund the retirement, but they would have to fund it with something else, and it funded a very small amount of retirement. But as the PR that we were getting was that that if you were to put a lot of money into these machines, you were raising the salary of teachers and sort of doing your little part for the social structure.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't imagine how that pissed me off. So I gave Eric a call and told him that, you know, we got to do something about that. Well, that afternoon, Eric sent over a set of principles for our boards to adopt in a press release that we would send out jointly, attacking the tavern owners and the people who were putting all this false information and undercutting money for education. So the rest is history on the merger.
Yeah, it seemed like it just fell into place. You guys were
ready.
Fell
into place.
Yeah.
I respected him, and I think he had a respect for me. He saw our strong points. MEA had a much better professional development conference, and we were working hard to develop it. I mean, we had as we built, we had our people who, I mean, this is before AFT had an ER&D program, but who, I mean, we used to meet and figure out ways that we could better do professional development and take over the days at the beginning of school to offer our idea instead of I mean, it kind of pissed teachers off, some of the people they drag in at the beginning of the school year. I don't know what's going on in MEA, but, you know, they're having a lot of the same feelings and the problems, but they made up for it a lot. And we get 2 days paid in October, which is coming up next week. And we're supposed to offer professional development in those days. Well, they had a really good program. We had a better COPE program.
Mm-hmm.
So we never, if only these other places could understand this, that are, they try to say, well, in other states, I've watched them, New Mexico or whatever, pick any place. Well, we got a better COPE program, or they argue, who's got the best COPE program? Well, we thought MFT had the best COPE program, and I knew, or Eric thought we did. I didn't know what he thought. But I knew they had a better professional development program. So here we had two programs. Now we have a third again number of members that are participating in this, and this gave us opportunities to work in other areas. So it was just coming together.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it should have.
What did your board think about this when you first started working together with MEA on the lottery issue?
Well, you got to read the article from Dick Barrett in one of those MEA MFD, or the last MEA MFD today.
Yeah.
After I moved over here, these were my friends and colleagues, and we were doing crazy things all the time. So they scratched their head, but I think there were a lot, not in higher ed, you know, they would have questioned, was this a wise thing, and would we get eaten up? State employees would have said the same thing, maybe. But in the public schools, I mean, these were cousins and sisters and brothers, and that one was in MFT and one was in MEA.
Mm-hmm.
And so, when we put together our merger teams, we both knew who we were putting on those merger teams in terms of were they visionaries or somebody that was pissed off at somebody from 10 years ago, and were they afraid to try new stuff, or did they just want to bitch about what happened in the past? And it was something to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Some days I had more friends from the MEA merger side than I did my own, because remember we were pretty strong headed, and it's interesting how we did both. We merged around a constitution, and there were a lot of things in the MEA constitution that we were doing, like the structure of the board. But we had little or no discussion on the AFL-CIO affiliation, because that was a deal going in. We had little or no discussion on should it be a teacher organization, or should it be all these people that were represented by MFT, because, I mean, we wouldn't be doing this if we were going to argue those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
So they were a given. So they were put into the first draft of the Constitution, and not only we gave every single local, including MFT locals, 1 year to opt out of the AFL-CIO. Nobody opted out.
Wow.
And when the MEA MFT, when Eric goes to the AFL-CIO convention, it's MEA MFT Local 8025, 16,000 members.
Mm-hmm.
And then brings a huge delegation.
Right.
You know, where we got 500 locals, maybe, or 350, say, it's not whether they show up or don't show up. The whole voting power of the MEA MFT is at that convention.
What were some of your sticking points, though? It seems really easy here, and New York had a hard time, Florida had a hard time.
Well, we did it around the Constitution. The MFT voted unanimously for it, and MEA voted 85%.